You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For Egyptian women, a great paradox came with the Arab Spring and the fall of Hosni Mubarak. Although they played a major role in the pro-democracy protests in Cairo's Tahrir Square, they now face a potential rollback of freedoms from the recently elected government. Women who had, without incident, stood shoulder to shoulder with men during those 18 days in early 2011 were subjected to sexual harassment and assault after the demonstrations ended. Egypt stands on the cusp of change, but the question remains, what kind of change? Will it move closer to the democratic values of full rights for all, or will the Muslim Brotherhood and more radical elements set back the rights of women and their role in Egyptian society? New Yorker staff writer Wendell Stevenson has published an article in the current issue of that magazine called Two Revolutions, What Has Egypt's Transition Meant for Its Women? Welcome to our show.
Hi.
We should point out that we're speaking to you from Jerusalem, and there'll be a little lag at times between when I ask you a question and you respond.
Possibly. Phone lines, yeah, very stretched. I'm sorry.
How important are women's issues to the Islamist movement in Egypt?
It varies. In some ways, they're central because it's an expression of how you want society to be and how you want women to be in that society. On the other hand, so culturally, they're kind of central. But politically, they're on the back burner at the moment. Politically, at the moment, the government is dealing with huge amounts of economic dislocation and all sorts of complications, and they're trying to shepherd through a new constitution at the moment. And the flavor of that and the tone of that is what's going to set the debate for further issues like women's issues further down the road. So at the moment, in the last sort of 4 or 5 months, the specifics about legislation and women's issues have been slightly on the back burner. But meanwhile, people are sort of struggling to find out what culturally this means, what the new atmosphere will mean for women in society.
Has the role women played in the Arab Spring protests in Tahrir Square been officially acknowledged?
Officially acknowledged by who? Who would be the officials who would acknowledge that?
Well, there are people who express gratitude, the new government, for example.
No, I mean to say that there's been no sort of clear-cut authority or body of authority since the revolution to a certain extent. And yes, people do acknowledge that role, but equally there was a lot of disquiet. Egypt is a conservative country, and although the kind of utopia of the 18 days and the sort of happiness and cooperation and the sort of almost carnival atmosphere that came on the square in that time was sort of widely leapt upon afterwards as a positive thing, as an inclusive thing, as a great sort of new Egypt moving forward together and this sort of thing. There was also a lot of disquiet about women sleeping next to men in tents, being on the square overnight, mingling with men in that sort of proximity. It's a conservative society, and it wasn't all. It's not only a positive reaction to that.
Weren't some signs of the troubles to come revealed by the assault on CBS reporter Lara Logan?
She was assaulted on the night Mubarak fell, and I was on the square that night. There were maybe 500,000 people on the square, so I certainly didn't see her or what happened specifically there. And in general, the atmosphere was melee and carnival and crazy and screaming and happy. But I do remember, and friends of mine remember, that it was almost as if something, a switch got flipped just at that moment. And certainly my behind was groped for the first time on the square that night, and other female friends of mine reported the same. So I don't know whether it was between the crush of numbers or different people coming onto the square or the fact that it was just the excitement or whatever, but suddenly something did change that night in the kind of rather marvelous utopia that we'd got used to in the preceding days seemed to come to a halt.
Had sexual harassment been a problem in Egyptian society before?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's been increasing over the last 10 or 15 years. I remember going to Egypt for the first time, I think, in 2000, And I remember then sort of being careful to be covered in the street, being careful not to sort of catch people's eyes, being sort of aware of myself as a blonde woman walking alone. And certainly the incidents of sexual harassment, taxi drivers, you know, gangs of young men shouting something, groping, hassling people, women on buses, or trying to sidle up too close to them, and all sorts of things like this. It's been going on for a while. And even before the revolution in 2006, there was a spate of really unpleasant mob attacks on women during one Eid celebration in downtown. So this is not a new phenomenon. This is not a post-revolution phenomenon. I think that the fact that the center of Cairo has been a bit lawless, and the absence of enough police on the street, and the sort of constant to and fro and riotous melee on Tahrir sometimes, which has a sort of ugly menacing tone, and scuffles and fights break out and different factions and so forth, has not helped the atmosphere, and certainly helped with women's security in those cases. So we've seen more mob attacks on women, really unpleasant, you know, where you get 50 or 60 or 70 men clawing, scratching, tearing at a woman's clothes, punching her to the ground and so forth. I mean, I've talked to women who this has happened to, and it's terrifying, absolutely terrifying.
Have you talked to any of the men who've engaged in this? What kind of explanation would they give for doing this sort of thing? There's obviously no religious rationale behind it.
No, the reasons for it are really hard to discern. I mean, I think that generally, it's clearly an issue in society. It's clearly an embedded issue. It's somehow socially acceptable to leer or shout or harass women. I think that the mob attacks is probably a function, as you know, mobs and crowds behave very strangely and very violently. And I think when you get a situation in holiday times and you've got a lot of people on the street, when you've had these, you know, ongoing demonstrations and crowds on Tahrir, often, as I said, of a kind of riotous, struggly, incoherent, often with a lot of young men and kids in the crowd and so forth, it creates these sort of strange, violent clump attacks. But generally, I think that it's an issue that society is beginning to, but has not yet addressed. I think to a certain extent, the previous government under Mubarak bears some responsibility for that, for not addressing it, for not educating people, certainly not setting an example. Many women activists I talked to referred, for example, to an incident in 2005 when the security services went into a crowd of demonstrators and sort of almost seemed to single out the women and grope them and harass them and pull their headscarves off. And
it's been called Black Wednesday.
Yeah, and this has been a feature of demonstrations ever since and after the revolution too, that women were treated like in this way. I mean, the men weren't getting off lightly either. They'd be beaten and tasered and so forth. But the women, they were particularly, and men too were sexually harassed and humiliated. But interestingly, men talk about that far less. But women seem to be targeted in a way to keep them off the square, to create an extra atmosphere of intimidation and violence and so forth. And I think that example somehow leaches into society. It becomes somehow sanctioned, and at least it goes unpunished.
And what happens when women complain? You write of them being humiliated in some cases, being given virginity tests, and being forced to strip naked while the door is open so everybody can look in.
Well, the virginity test was a particular incident that happened just after the revolution, when there was the first big demonstration on Tahrir, March 9th, I think, after the revolution, and the army sort of thought everything was done and over, and they, uncomfortable with this kind of querulous crowd, waded in very heavy-handed, beat and tortured a lot of the men, and dragged off several women who were then subjected to forcible virginity tests, in quote-unquote, by an army doctor in prison with the door left open to the sort of leers of the guards outside. I mean, this to a certain extent was so shocking and relatively unusual, was not common practice before, that when it first began to be talked about, when some of the women went to human rights lawyers and the story began to come out, a lot of Egyptians just didn't believe it. But eventually, one brave woman, Samira Ibrahim, did bring the matter to trial, and it was deemed in one court unlawful, and that practice has been stopped. And it was interesting that afterwards, last spring, for example, there were several demonstrations, and immediately the army arrested people. They were very quick to let the women go first, you know. So it was interesting that in that case, in that particular instance, they've been held accountable.
Well, in Samira Ibrahim's case, her family supported her decision to speak out, but that didn't happen with another woman, Hind Badawi. What happened there?
Well, Hind is a rather remarkable woman. I met, she comes from the town of Banha, which is 30 or 40 kilometers north of Cairo. She comes from a village, which is a very traditional, normal village on the banks of the Nile. And she was excited by the revolution. She didn't go to Tahrir during the initial demonstrations, but afterwards she went several times. And before Christmas last year, I think early December last year, she was attacked by military police on the square, badly beaten, tasered, had her headscarf dragged off, her wrists broken, and ended up in military hospital and then in civilian hospital. And when she was finally let out, her family, of course, was furious that she had got herself into this situation, shamed the family, and they, for several months, you know, locked her up, wouldn't let her out. Her elder brother beat her. They told her to be quiet, to not talk about this thing, that she would never get married, and so forth. I think that for a lot of traditional Egyptian families, the idea of a woman being independent, going onto the square, being alone, being in a situation with men, with boys, with violence, is unacceptable culturally as what a woman should do or how she should comport herself. But also there's a certain extent that they're worried for their daughters, for their sisters and wives and so forth, because it's clear what can happen at the hands of the security services. So there's a sort of double-edged sword. You know, one hand is a sort of overprotection, which is used as a justification for then trying to stop them demonstrating.
But Ms. Badawi says she wants women's rights within the context of her religion, and she said, "I had the opportunity to mix my inner revolution with the revolution of my country." She's no radical.
No, not at all. You know, she's 23 years old. She's just done a master's in education. She's traditionally dressed. She wears a headscarf and a pair of jeans and dresses modestly and colorfully, like the majority of women, young women her age in Egypt. And she grew up, you know, wanting to be a modest and a good girl according to her Islamic values. What she doesn't want to do, however, is to be constrained and dictated to. It was interesting to me talking to her and to other women who used exactly the same term. She, for her, it was not about Islam. It was about these customs and traditions. She kept referring to these customs and traditions, rolling her eyes, you know, rueful and regretful and frustrated, the cultural constraints of the expectations of, you know, how women should behave and so forth, that they shouldn't mix with men, that they shouldn't talk to them, they shouldn't be alone with them, and certainly going independently into Cairo, into Tahrir, and standing on the barricades next to them was really a step too far.
My guest is Wendell Stevenson, staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article, Two Revolutions, What Has Egypt's Transition Meant for Its Women, is in the current issue of that magazine. Why do you think Egyptian women have remained so conservative, considering the overall level of literacy, education, and work experience many of them have? And most of them wear the hijab by choice, don't they?
They do, and that's changed over the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, I think there's a sort of paradox at work that you can see all over the Arab world, where the increasing Islamification, the increasing conservatism of societies. You know, Egypt in the 50s and 60s, you know, had, you know, funny movies with, you know, women and men and almost romantic comedy type things. And somehow this the tone and tenor of society changed. I think sometimes it's just a phase or a period of time. I sometimes think that it's a reaction to the dictatorships that they were living under to a certain extent. You know, communism had been discredited. The West was discredited by its wars in the Middle East and its support of Israel. And a lot of people, I think, in the region recuse themselves into religion as a kind of, as a way to retain identity, as a way to have a kind of moral compass, to be on the right path. And that was separate from the corrupt or brutal governments they were living under. And separate, too, from a sort of Western model or an example, which for a lot of people seems profligate and promiscuous and somehow depraved. So I think it's a sort of moral recusement and a way to follow a path that they're comfortable with in the face of a difficult public political sphere.
And I would assume, based on the story of Miss Badawi and her family's reaction, that women are afraid in some cases to speak out because their families may shun them and they may be stigmatized in their communities.
Very much so. I mean, I talked to a lot of women, many of whom didn't make it into the article, but who have become active and activists and so forth, and almost all of them had the story of having to overcome the misgivings and mores and constraints of their family. And those battles for those women are very painful. It can be violent in the case of Hind Badawi when she was, you know, beaten by her brother and locked up and so forth, but it's also, you know, endlessly arguments, endless pressure.
Although it didn't stop her from yelling at the Field Marshal Mohammed Tantawi when he came to her hospital room.
Well, this is a rather extraordinary thing, is that I found with Hind and many other examples of Egyptian women this rather sort of fierce indomitableness, you know, and almost an obduracy of willpower. It's interesting that I think out of I've been in a lot of Arab countries, and Egypt, almost more than all of them, has you know, these really strong women who you know, are not shy to stand up for themselves and quite often fight battles that are as difficult as we could imagine, because they're battles against the people they love the most. They're battles against their family, their societies, their friends, and they're battles that may impact their future. I mean, Hind's family was worried for her safety, but they were also incredibly worried. You know, they kept, her aunt kept saying to her, well, who's going to, you know, you'll have to get married one day. Who's going to want to marry you? So stepping out of those confines, rejecting the mores and so forth from where you come is a really tough thing to do. But it's interesting to me that when I talk to women who had done it, although they had endured, you know, often several years of difficulty and arguments and to and fro and all the rest of it, quite often at the end, their parents, their fathers, their families came to some acceptance that they were going to be who they wanted to be. So it seemed like those were battles worth fighting and that there was you know, light at the end of the tunnel.
What was Hosni Mubarak's government like in this regard? Didn't his wife, Suzanne, really fight for the rights of women in Egypt?
Well, there was a series of reforms in the late Mubarak period. I mean, considering he'd been in power for 30 years, it was that women's issues weren't exactly his priority. I mean, he got to them in the last 3 or 4 years of his reign. But as he and his son Gamal were trying to economically liberalize the country and open it up to foreign investment, and they had to do it really, they needed World Bank money and sign-offs and investment and so forth, they realized they had to make a show, too, internationally, of seeming to open up a little bit to civil society and social liberalization. And so they did allow in the mid-90s the opening of NGOs, which they were constrained, they were curtailed, they were quite well organized, but it did spark the beginnings of a civil society, which is now being grown upon. And there were also several pieces of legislation passed, now known as Suzanne Mubarak's laws, because she made a point of championing them, although most of the work was done, I think, by women's issues activists and NGOs who were had been lobbying for this legislation for years. But once Suzanne got on the bandwagon, the legislation went through, particularly to make divorce easier for women to initiate, to raise the age of marriage, to allow women to pass on their nationality in some circumstances to their children. And most importantly, of course, in 2008, female circumcision was outlawed.
Well, isn't there a threat now because of the Noor Party of the Salafis putting pressure on the Islamic Brotherhood that some of these things will be rolled back?
There is. And before Parliament was dissolved in the kind of total melee confusion before the presidential election, there had been quite a lot of noises coming out from Islamist MPs, Salafis in particular, about lowering the age of marriage for women and rolling some of these things back. In particular, now there's a sort of abeyance of legislative talk while there's still this ongoing process in getting a constitution in place. At the moment, the fight is about the wording of the constitution, and the Salafis have called a big demonstration on Tahrir this weekend, I believe. So the question is whether Sharia should be the main principle of legislation, or legislation should just be based on the principles of Sharia. And this battle is the background one and the important one at the moment. This is the battle that's separating the Salafis on one hand and the liberals on the other, with the Muslim Brotherhood being a sort of their usual cagey, rather incommunicative, awkward selves in the middle, as to where this comes down, because that will shape the tenor and tone of legislation in the future.
But didn't scholars at Al-Azhar University recently rule that reforms made under President Mubarak do not conflict with Sharia law?
They did.
That doesn't have much clout?
It does, but it's Egypt, and these things tend to be complicated. Al-Azhar is a venerable university of many centuries standing, and its rulings on Islamic jurisprudence are very well respected. However, there are different currents within Al-Azhar, and control of Al-Azhar is sort of in flux a little bit, and the way it's organized and its authority and what legal standing its role would be and what's legal standing its pronouncements would have is all very much in flux. So it's hoped, I think, by moderates and that Al-Azhar can provide a kind of good, solid, moderate buffer to some of these more extremist calls from Salafis and so forth. But it's not yet clear who is going to control Al-Azhar, because clearly the Brotherhood and the Salafis are jockeying in there, and there's also independent movements. And it's not clear what role they will have legislatively after the constitution is made, whether it will be that they will advise on legislation, or that they will be able to veto certain bits of legislation.
So you're saying it's unclear what the situation will be for
much
women in the near future.
Much is unclear. It's a country without a constitution, and this is what the fight and the debate is now.
And don't women have any say in this fight and debate?
Not much. They're in the sense that the constitutional committee is, I think it has a smattering of women on it, but not very many, is seen to be dominated by the Islamist faction. And so this is the contention at the moment, and what compromise or what awkward compromise or what wording is going to come out of that body. And at the moment, it is noticeable that women are largely out of that debate. And it was noticeable, too, that in the first parliamentary election, for example, I think there were only 9 women MPs out of several hundred elected. It was one of the lowest female representations for an elected body anywhere in the world. And it was sort of staggeringly pathetic and rather dispiriting. So there's women's participation in civil society, in politics, needs to improve, and it probably will. There's only one way to go from nine, which is probably to increase it. They'll have new parliamentary elections, so you know, hopefully some of this stuff will be redressed, but it's an awkward interim, there's no doubt.
Wendell Stevenson is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article, Two Revolutions, What Has Egypt's Transition Meant for Its Women, is in the current issue. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Great pleasure. Thank you, too.